Sample size and who had telephones and automobiles and so forth. We were kind of seeing something similar these days in that more and more people are getting rid of their landlines, more and more people getting rid of their landlines and going to cell phones. How has that changed the way polls are conducted? And does this speak to the does this affect the reliability of polls?
It could, and it would if the major pollsters didn't know how. Now, you know, they now know how to handle the fact that over a third of the American public has only a cell phone. They cannot be reached on a landline anymore, and a number of election and political polls are still conducted on the telephone. And the better ones nowadays are a mixture of a sample that's drawn from the landline, the traditional wired telephone, and a sample that's drawn from the cell phone group of telephone numbers. This didn't come about really to seem to matter. In other words, incorporating cell phone numbers and interviews of people who are reached on their cell phone didn't seem to really matter until around the 2008 election. The size of the American population that was a mobile or cell phone only characteristic grew rapidly from the early 2000, the early part of the previous decade. And the characteristics of in particular, the voting tendencies of the people who were cell phone only weren't different enough to matter at the time that they were representing a relatively, 5-10% of the population. But nowadays, you're talking about over a third of the population is cell phone only here in the United States. And the characteristics of that group all along have been different than a random sample of the public. They're disproportionately younger adults. They're disproportionately renters as opposed to homeowners. They're more central city and also more rural. They're a little bit more minority. And so all these characteristics that I'm mentioning are correlated with political opinions and voting tendencies. And so if you're going to do a telephone approach to sampling and gathering data for an election poll, if you don't incorporate cell phone numbers into your sample, it's not likely that you're going to be accurate.
Now, one of the things that's happening in opinion research is the use of the internet. How is that working? And I would think the big fear there would be a lot of how do you have an internet poll that isn't self-selected?
Well, it's hard to come by. There are some organizations that take an approach to building an internet panel for research purposes they can argue is a scientific base, the way they approach that. There are other organizations that do very sophisticated statistical adjustments to their volunteer panels, and they can point to quite an accurate record in terms of their ability to predict election outcomes. But there's an even larger group of internet-based organizations, research organizations, that aren't as reliable as we need them to be, and their record shows that they're not. And so one of the things that people should take away from listening or thinking about the results of an internet-based survey is the organization that conducts it and their methodology will make a big difference in how likely it's accurate to be, how accurate it's likely to be. I've seen past evidence where on the same topic at the same time, you have sometimes as much as a 20 percentage point difference across different internet survey methodologies. And that's not, you know, that something like that at the time of an election tells us absolutely nothing about the outcome in terms of if you have that kind of variability. So you have to, I'm not trying to suggest that there aren't organizations that do a very rigorous approach to internet sampling and also apply it at the time of elections, and they have a solid record of being quite accurate. But there's tremendous variation across different internet companies.
I would think that that some of the demographic data collected might be a little questionable because you're filling out a form, you can put in anything you want. I mean, because some of these panels are used for marketing products, you can kind of predict how many product invitations you'll get depending on what you put in for an income. And if you, for example, put in that you make less than $20,000 a year, you're not likely to hear from anybody. And if you put in a higher income, say something over $50,000, your email inbox is suddenly inundated with the suggestions that you buy this or that, or you take this or that credit card, or something like that. But I guess the point is that when you have, perhaps this actually applies to phone polls too, because when you ask somebody, you know, you collect demographic information. Well, it's generally pretty easy by listening to somebody to tell whether they're male or female. But when they give you their approximate age or the other information they give you, how do you know they're telling you the truth? I guess is the point I'm making here.
I have several responses. Let me start at a general level with the last point that you made. Under what circumstances do we think that demographic information that's reported in a poll is likely to be accurate? Well, the you know, 99% of the polls that I encounter that are conducted on the telephone, there's little reason for people to falsify to any great extent their demographics. They're typically gathered at the end of the survey. It's done relatively quickly. The interviewers are trained to be very encouraging and reminding people that this is being kept in confidence. And furthermore, John, there have been a number of what we would call methodological record checks. In other words, studies in which you go back and verify what people's characteristics are, compare it to what they self-reported, and it's highly accurate. You may know that the one demographic characteristic that people are reluctant to answer in a survey, regardless of what mode you gather it in, is their income. Whereas you get, unless you ask income in a rather sophisticated way, you get about a third of the people claiming they either don't know their income or they outright refuse that, so they're not answering it. But on the Internet, I'm going to shift to the first thing you asked about. On the Internet, you are correct. There is a significant problem of people falsifying their identity so that they can be asked to participate in all kinds of polls, which they are rewarded in some way, whether it's through points or cash or whatever. And so the whole idea of falsification of your identity so that you can qualify multiple times to participate in a panel is recognized as a potential major threat to the accuracy of surveys. And new techniques, there are new companies that have sprouted out in the last 5 years that are the better Internet polls now verify the identity of their members through these independent companies. So that's become an industry in itself.
We're talking about polling this hour because, well, it's the election season. Some call it the silly season, the election season, and a lot of us are being asked to participate in polls, and we're certainly hearing about them almost every hour of the day. Someone comes out with a new set of numbers about various things connected to politics these days. So we're talking about polling. We're talking about what makes a poll valid and invalid, how polls are conducted, and which kinds of polls we can trust and which kind we should maybe look at with a jaundiced eye. My guest is Paul Lavrakis, president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. He's also the co-author of Voter's Guide to Election Polls. Wondering what you think about this. Have you participated in a poll? And how was that experience for you? How did you feel about it? Maybe you've never been polled. I know people say, hey, they never ask my opinion. How do we know that, you know, they didn't get my opinion? How can that poll be right? We'll talk a little bit about sample size and how that applies when we come back. We're going to take a short break. If you've got a question about opinion polling, we have the expert here for you to talk to at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can go there and leave a question or a comment, and we'll share it on the air. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later today on Talk of the Nation, as Egyptians voted in the country's first free presidential elections, both Islamists and former regime could not let the other side win. Still, many expressed hope. After one on Talk of the Nation, a look at Egypt after the elections. That's coming up later today on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about opinion polling. And my guest is Paul Lavrakis. He's the co-author of The Voter's Guide to Election Polls, and he's also the president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. We have a lot of people who want to join us by phone, and we'll start taking calls in just a moment. I just wanted to put this question to you. It was originally thought, I think, in polling that the more people you, the bigger your sample size, the more accurate your poll is likely to be. But as I understand it, that's not really true, is it? What makes a poll valid or invalid in terms of sample size?
Well, how is the initial sample drawn? How is it chosen? If it's done in a random way, which means it's arbitrary, the people that you're trying to gather information from aren't playing a role in determining you're picking them. They're not, in other words, they didn't sign up for a list and said to you, well, yeah, anytime you want to do a survey, I'd be glad to participate. So they haven't self-selected themselves. You know, traditionally that has been the key hallmark of accuracy from a sampling standpoint. However, John, a serious concern has happened over the last 20 years in particular, and that is that a lot of people that are sampled to participate in scientific surveys, polls included, end up not wanting to participate. They refuse. And so that then starts characterizing the resulting sample as opposed to the sample that was originally chosen, that the resulting sample is really not much more than a self-selected sample. And people make a decision about participating in any given survey for varying reasons. Typically the topic, the group that's conducting the survey, how busy the person is at the time you reach them, and as a result, are you doing multiple callbacks or contacts to people that are too busy the first time you try them? So there's a lot of things going on here, but ultimately the traditional view has been that if you select a group of people randomly, that you're going to avoid the biases of self-selection.
And you have to actually make, let's say you're doing a telephone poll, you have to actually make quite a few calls to get a valid response. I had a little experience in this about 10 years ago, conducting qualitative research for a local television station, and we found that we had to make about 3,000 calls in order to get about somewhere between 450 and 500 valid responses. And when I first heard that, you know, that I was going to have to do that, I thought, well, this is crazy. We'll never get it done. But you really do have to make an awful lot of calls to get enough valid responses to make the poll worthwhile, don't you?
If you're doing the telephone mode, which, you know, the majority of the polling that we read about is coming from telephone surveys at election time, the example you cited is certainly indicative of what can happen, but it's a rosy picture, John, compared to what is often happening. Let's take and I'll just say this quickly. Let's take a typical media poll that a major news organization is conducting in which they want 1,000 completed interviews, and we could talk about why that 1,000 is a good number for the purpose to which the news media typically want to put the results of a poll. It has what we say a plus or minus 3 percentage point general level of accuracy. But to get those 1,000 completions, it's not unusual nowadays for a media poll this year that might last 4 to 5 days, and then it might start on a Thursday and end on a Sunday, gathering the data. It's not unusual to get less than 1 in 10 of the households that you've sampled to actually give you data. So bump that up to 10,000 telephone numbers. Beyond that, you're using random telephone numbers that are created, and you don't know in advance which ones are actually working, which ones aren't. And if you're lucky, maybe you have about 60 or 70% of the telephone numbers that actually are working, as opposed to just ring no answer, not in service, et cetera. And there's a reason you want to create those telephone numbers randomly for that purpose. And so this is moving your total numbers that you have to dial maybe upwards of 20,000 to end up with. Okay, and then you have to call these numbers multiple times. On average it might take 3 callbacks to get a completion. So let's take 20,000 and multiply that times 3 and say that you might need to dial 60,000 times to get 1,000 completed. And furthermore, a lot of people may not know this. In the United States, when you're calling cell phone numbers in which you have not been given permission to call by the owner of the cell phone number, you have to manually dial that. And so this is a massive effort to just get something, as you said, as few as 400 or 500 completions.
Wow. It's a lot of work.
It certainly is.
Let's go to the phones. We have full phone banks. A lot of people want to ask questions about polls. I think we all have opinions about opinion polls. Let's talk to Bill in Madison first. Bill, thanks for holding.
Hello. I guess this is a comment followed by a question, because I'm not sure whether my opinion is justified. I'd like to find out. I'm generally hostile to opinion polls. The Republicans are calling me all the time, and I either refuse to participate or I just outright lie. In general, I'm hostile to polls because I think the term scientific poll is an oxymoron. I just don't think that there's, because I know that there's a huge difference. There's what's called the Edsel effect. You know, Ford took opinion polls and focus groups up the yazoo when they were developing the Edsel, and they discovered to their shock and horror once they got the car on the market that what people said they wanted and what decision they actually made were often quite different. And so I just don't believe in the scientific validity of most polls. And so when a pollster states a margin of error of a certain percentile, what are the assumptions he makes in order for him to come up with that kind of a number? And I'll take my answer off the air.
John, should I respond?
Yes, please do.
Well, Bill raised a lot of important and interesting issues, and let me see if I can quickly touch on the ones, but I'll start with his last explicit question first. Generally, if you have a sample that's been drawn randomly, the pollster then can compute the formulas. It can actually use the formula to calculate what we call a margin of error. You have given everyone in your population of interest a non-zero chance of being chosen. That's sort of theoretically, but that's generally what you need to do. And you, the researcher, need to know what any individual person you interview, what their probability of being chosen is. So, for example, someone that has four phone lines at home, two cell phones and two landlines, that person has four times as many chances as being chosen for a survey as a person who only has one phone at home. And so these two characteristics, a non-zero chance of being chosen and a known chance of being chosen, are what are required to do these calculations. However, John and Bill, not all pollsters apply these rules, these statistical rules, and so they will claim to know the margin of error on surveys and samples that they have no basis whatsoever to say what the margin of error is. So that's one comment. The other one that Bill didn't specifically ask about is that there's a lot of fake or pseudo polling that is going on under the name of legitimate polling. And not only is that unethical, but in many cases, it's probably illegal. And so we have a term, we have two terms, actually, sugging, S-U-G-G-I-N-G, and frugging, F-U-G-G-I-N-D. Sales under the guise of polling and fundraising under the guise of polling. And so a lot of the political party contacts, I actually had one earlier this morning, an organization called Our House, and it was a robo-poll where you have one of these automatic responses. And I could tell right from the start that this was not a legitimate survey. It was simply a pretending to do a legitimate survey with ultimately an intent to either convince me of some partisan point of view or ultimately get me to agree to give information that would allow them to then follow up with a fundraising call. So there's a lot of things that are going on that characterize unethical polling, they're pseudo polling and so forth. I don't mean to plug our book, the book that Professor Traugott at the University of Michigan and I have written about election polls, but we cover all these issues because it's very complicated nowadays to know under what circumstance are you likely to be able to, you know, believe the results? Or even if you're contacted, is this person really contacting you in a legitimate way?
Well, and talk a little bit about push polling.
Well, push polling is that latter kind that I mentioned. I didn't use the term, but it's really political telemarketing. It's not anything that has anything to do with polling, be it scientific or not. It's the whole idea that they're gathering data is phooey. It's not true. What they're doing is they're trying to pretend that they're engaging you and they're interested in your opinions, but their whole purpose is to give you messages that are highly partisan. And the way they word the questions is how they try to fool their listeners by making them sound like real opinion questions, but they're so slanted that what their whole purpose is to convey a partisan point of view about a topic.
We have an email from Richard who asks, how does any poll or survey determine the margin of error? How accurate is that?
Again, it's not unlike what Bill was just asking. If it has what we call a probability sample, you randomly choose people, you know something about the probability of their being chosen, you can properly apply the statistical formulas that quantify the imprecision, the uncertainty around a number. So if you see a poll that 53% of registered voters support Romney, 46% because 1% don't answer, 46% support Obama. So you got a 53-46, you got a 7-point gap there. And then you see that the margin error of that poll is plus or minus 5 percentage points. Well, if you go up 5 points from Romney and down 5 points from Romney and do the same thing with Obama, you would see that that range overlaps. And strictly speaking, you should be concluding that on the basis of the poll, the finding would say that the election opinions are too close to call. They're overlapping. So this margin of error is a way of quantifying the uncertainty on any survey that is done. And it's applied incorrectly to many kinds of surveys and polls that aren't what we call probability samples. They weren't chosen randomly, and the researchers have no business applying this margin of error to it. Doesn't mean that I wanted to jump back to something I said earlier. It doesn't mean that some of these self-selected ways of sampling are always wrong. It's just that under many circumstances, we have no way of knowing when they are likely to be right or when they are likely to be wrong.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from David in Desmer, Michigan.
Yes.
David, good morning.
Well, my question is about the questions themselves, like abortion polls. They say either you're for or against. A lot of people are in the middle. And even when they do have a 1-2-5 type thing, really for, really against, I hurt my back a while back. Before my back was 8, I would have said I was 10 in pain. But then my disc ruptured. Now, if you ask me after my disruption, my pain beforehand I would have rated it down to like a 2, and now the new pain was 10. So, things change.
Well, David, I know exactly what you're saying, and this is a major challenge that the wording of the questions themselves, but as you say, the response scales. What choices are you giving people? We nowadays, the kind of quick turnaround polling that most people do require this multiple choice approach where you don't let people answer in their own words. And so the actual way you label the choices that you give people, can make a big difference on whether the data you get in are likely to be accurate, reliable, or not. The first example that you cited is what we called a forced choice. You're forced to pick just what they give you. They don't give you an opportunity, or they don't make it clear to you that you have an opportunity to say that you're undecided or uncertain and so forth. But I can say this, John, to all your listeners. If you're participating in a poll and you are uncertain, never hesitate to tell the interviewer that you are uncertain and expect that they should accept that answer from you. And if they claim that they can't accept that answer, they are doing something that they shouldn't. I don't know what they're doing, but they're not doing a legitimate poll, in my mind. They need to be able to accept that uncertain answer from people, even if they don't volunteer it. A more sophisticated, careful approach to a lot of political opinion questions would be to pose the answers that you're giving people to choose from, and then to add, or are you uncertain on this topic, or are you, have you not made up your mind yet on this topic? So there's a lot to be said about the accuracy of polls based on how good the questionnaires themselves are. And one of the things that in the history of the research on surveys and polls has consistently shown is that small wording changes can make big differences in the answers you get from people.
I want to talk more about that because that was that's a huge area of discussion, the wording of questions and how the wording affects the answers. But we need to take a break. We will pick that up when we come back. We also have some more callers on the line. We'll ask you to stay with us. We'll get to your calls as soon as we can. And still room for a couple more folks if you'd like to join in. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. And the Kathleen Dunn Show is also on Facebook. You can find us there as well. My guest is Paul Lavrakis. He is co-author of The Voter's Guide to Election Polls, and he's also president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of WPR. 9:44, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour, well, last week, Star Wars celebrated its 35th anniversary, and we'll be talking about the cultural significance of the Star Wars franchise. So heavy geek alert for next hour's discussion. We're really looking forward to it. This hour, we're talking about opinion polling. It's always in the news. Practically every newscast you listen to here on Wisconsin Public Radio has the word of a new poll or a new piece of opinion research. We get the calls at home. We get requests on the internet to be part of polling panels and so forth. And we read about this stuff all the time. So we're talking about polls and about how they're done and when they're done right and what they mean and why we do them. My guest is Paul Lavrakis, who is the president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research and also the co-author of the book Voter's Guide to Election Polls. All right. Now, I mentioned I teased to this before the break, so I have to follow through and support the lead, as it were. The wording of questions is something that is crucial to obtaining valid answers, and it's kind of like the old computer adage: garbage in, garbage out. You won't if you don't ask the right questions, you won't get the information you're looking for, and that can just be a mistake. And if there is nefarious intent, the way you word a poll question can skew the results one way or another. Talk a little bit about how that works and how careful you have to be in how you word the questions.
There's a lot of work that a careful pollster goes through to look at the likelihood that their questions, as they're going to be worded in the survey, are going to generate accurate information. And as I mentioned before the break in responding to David's question, there's two parts to a question. There's the stem, the question itself, and then there's the response choices. You know, because so many of our questions are what we call closed-end. We, the researchers, provide the range of acceptable answers. And so there's a history of political questions that you can, and a literature that you can go back. And there are books on this that, you know, that have lists of questions that have been found over the years to be reliable. But when you come up with a new topic, a relatively new topic, and I'll use this one for an example, same-sex marriage, you don't have a long history to know how to ask these questions. And so it's incumbent upon you as a careful pollster to do a lot of pilot testing and pre-testing. And it could include what we call cognitive interviews. You bring people into a laboratory setting one-on-one. You ask them you teach them how to use a technique that we call thinking out loud. And then you take them through your questionnaire, exposing them to new questions that you're developing, and see how their mind is processing those words. Cognitive psychologists have done a great amount of research on the way that people process questions and formulate answers. And so it's much more time-consuming and sophisticated than most people would understand when a careful pollster goes along. But let me give you a quick example. If you're sort of thinking about the issue, and I'll use the example of same-sex marriage because I was just teaching about this last semester in my political science research class that I teach at a local university where I live. And so if you take same-sex marriage and you think, well, there are just really two sides to this. You know, people are either for it or against it. Maybe they're uncertain. So you know, maybe you can ask the question, and then you sort of ask people, well, do you agree with this? Do you oppose it? Or haven't you made up your mind? But the problem with that is that there are a lot of people who aren't willing to agree or support the concept of same-sex marriage, who are sympathetic and supportive of the concept of allowing civil unions. And so unless you put that additional option in there, you're going to exacerbate and, in my mind, distort the negative view on that question. So again, there's so much that goes into the way a careful pollster chooses her questions for the questionnaire. And as we're saying here, it's extremely important. This is a very important decision that a pollster is making.
Let's go to the phones again, and we'll take a call. This time we'll go to La Crosse and talk to Jeff. Jeff,
hello?
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Okay. I can barely hear you now. You're coming in clear before. Anyhow, I was calling about a recent poll that I saw on Facebook and from Politico.com, and after listening to your program, I think it might have been a variation of what he mentioned earlier of sugging. I took the poll, and then they gave me what sounded to be legitimate, a telephone number that I had to call to verify that I was who I was and that was a legitimate poll. And so I called the toll-free number, and they asked me a bunch of questions. And then they said, okay, we'll get to the poll in just a second, and they tried to sell me something. And I thought, oh, man, I've been had. And I was then curious to see how it would all unfold. And he was pretty tenacious. They didn't want to let me go thinking they might be able to make a sale. They worked the political questions into it, and as they went along and finally, when I said no, I wasn't going to be buying anything, then it was pretty much over.
Jeff, you shouldn't feel bad. That happens to all of us on occasion until we realize that that's unfortunately something we have to guard against. You know, if the questions that someone is asking you don't sound as though they're worded right, or if you ask them questions, anyone who's being asked to participate in a survey over the telephone in particular has the right to ask any questions about that survey that come to mind. And so if they're reluctant to answer those questions, such as who are you calling for, who are you again, how long is this going to take, what are you going to do with the data, if they don't have ready and reasonable answers for questions like that, it should put you on your guard. There are times when a legitimate political poll will say an interviewer will be trained to say the following: I can't tell you who we're conducting this poll for until you finish it, because it might bias the answers you provide to some of the questions. But then they should immediately tell you who the sponsor was or who their organization is, in case their organization, by telling you, would tip you off in some way that could possibly bias you. But no one who's doing legitimate polling should outright claim that they will not or cannot tell you who they are. And I would encourage all the listeners to just politely hang up at that moment if that's what you hear back.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Let's go next to Tim in New Berlin. Tim, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I hope you can hear me. You kind of faded out right there, like the previous caller. But my question regards Charles Franklin and the Marquette poll. I would like to know who funds that poll, who frames the questions. Why did he – see, orig- originally he announced that he was going to be at UW in Madison conducting the poll, and then he said Marquette, and that was because he was asked about who was funding the poll, and at a public university, he has to answer up. And is it true, and Charles Franklin, it has been reported, used to work for the Bradley Foundation, and this looks like a front for Walker. And I'm just wondering why everybody puts so much faith, it seems, into this Marquette Law School poll when, in fact, it never even existed until now, and it looks like a partisan scam, don't you think?
If I could just preface my answer by saying I know Charles. I've worked with him in 2008 on one of the for one of the national news medias in covering the exit polls. And so I'm just acknowledging that I know Charles. The question is a very important one, and especially when you're talking about someone at a public university, it is their ethical responsibility as a researcher to disclose openly and honestly, without hesitation, the type of information that you were asking about. And I have no reason to know or think that Charles wouldn't disclose it right away. That's the information you were asking about is a standard kind of information that should be readily disclosed.
Tim, thanks for the call. Gene in Eau Claire is next. Gene, good morning. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, yep, I have the same situation of you fading out. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and talk.
Okay, well, go.
I can't hear you, but I'm going to tell you about a situation that happened to me. I was one of the people who signed a recall petition, and I was called regarding a research, questionnaire, and it was a research questionnaire, and they asked for me by name, and, I said, now, who is paying for this survey? And they said, well, they don't know, they weren't told, and so I went through the survey with them. They didn't say it was political or anything like that. And as they were going through, I realized that it was somewhat political. And I've had those before, and I've had the different types. And this one was a little bit concerning because some of the questions were, are you a union member? Have you ever worked for a union? Does anybody in your family belong to a union? Where do you work? What would keep you from going to the polls? Then they wanted to confirm my telephone number and my name, and I was ready to hang up, and I said, this is it. And then they told me that this was sponsored by Friends of Walker, and I was really concerned. I'm going to have to take my answer off the air because I can't hear you. Thank you.
This is an example, again, it sounds as though it's an example of a unethical effort to gather information, not in this case to sell you anything or to get you to agree to fund something, but to gather information specifically for political strategizing that's not in the way that we would think that surveys are supposed to be done, unless people acknowledge it right up front, and they obviously didn't in this case. I want to tell all the listeners that if you are contacted for something that you suspect is unethical under the guise of research, no matter what the purpose they claim it is, but you suspect it's unethical, you can report this to our association, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, aapor.org, www.aapor.org. You can report instances like this, and we will do our utmost to follow up and try to determine whether they're legitimate or not. We have a standards committee. This falls under their purview. Pseudo polls, push polls are investigated routinely by our standards committee.
And what happens when they're reviewed? I mean, does your body have any way to enforce its will on
We don't.
On
we
bad
don't
posters?
Have anything other than the ability to be have a prestigious organization which is nonpartisan, publicize, release a press release, if we believe that an organization is doing something that is unethical, and they refuse to change what they're doing. We had an instance like this 2 years ago where, in this case, the organization, the survey organization, was, we learned later, was making up the data that they were reporting. And their clients apparently didn't even know it. So we don't have any enforcement other than the what we can publicize about the cases. And we do this, and we can do it with vigor because we're nonpartisan. We don't take any position. Unethical practices we want to expose.
Well, we're out of time, and thank you for an interesting conversation. I'd like to continue this because I have about a page and a half of questions I didn't get to, and we did have some callers left at the end of the show. So maybe note to the producers, we should probably do this program again. Thank you very much for joining me this morning, Paul Lavrakis. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, John, and thanks to all the listeners. I enjoyed talking with you and to hearing their questions, and I hope it was of some help.
I'm sure it was. Paul Lavrakis is president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. The program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, who also handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.